This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guests this month are Jack Shainman and Carlos Vega from the school in Kinderhook, formerly the Martin Van Buren High School, now a fine arts exhibition space and occasional venue for concerts. Following the interview, two compositions performed at the school in February by the Broad Street Orchestra and the Broad Street Chorale, conducted by David Smith. First, Arthur Foote's suite for string orchestra, and then Saint-Saëns, La Nuit. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here at the school in Kinderhook with the founder, Jack Shainman. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm sure you have told the story a thousand times, but how did you happen to acquire this building?
Well, my partner and I, Carlos Vega, have a place right nearby in Stuyvesant, New York, in northern Stuyvesant. And Kinderhook was always such a beautiful place to come. And it happened to be driving by one day and seeing that the Martin Van Buren High School was for sale. And I said, we have to go see it. Just we have to go see. And one thing led to another, and here we are.
And then you found an architect.
Yes, we did. A dear friend of ours who unfortunately has passed away, Antonios Torresillas. And really, he was kind of a genius, to tell you the truth. And I appreciate so much what he did for us here at the school, the way he used the bones of the building to make the space and let the building speak for itself.
Yeah, it's totally a museum-like space.
Oh, thank you.
And full of beautiful light.
Yes, he's the way he worked on the light, the spaces, the openness, and the heights.
Some quite extensive work in the large room that you lowered a floor by several feet?
Yes, well, actually it was the gymnasium that had just a crawl space underneath it. It had never been dug out. And so we literally cut the gymnasium floor in the center, took it out, and then excavated in order for us to achieve 24-foot ceiling height, which was what I wanted all along. And Antonio figured out a way to do that. It was kind of brilliant.
Now, you had galleries in New York for a long time.
Yes, since I opened in New York in 1986.
And your concentration has been sort of parts of the world that are not necessarily well represented in the Western market.
Especially now. But even back when we first started the gallery, we brought in a lot of artists that had never, from Europe, that had never shown before in New York. So, yeah, we were always interested in bringing in things that hadn't been thought about or considered.
And where did you start out? Were you in Soho originally?
We opened the first, Claude Simard, my partner, who I opened the gallery with. We first opened in Washington, D.C., believe it or not. And that's, I always joke, that's where we learned to sell snow to Eskimos. It was really hard. D.C. has gotten so nice now. But back then, wow, it was a tough city. But we got our start there, but soon realized that we needed to be in New York if we wanted to do something substantial.
And so when did you move to New York?
Washington was from October 84, and then we opened in New York. We got the space in 85, but opened in January of 86.
So it didn't take you long to reach that conclusion.
Yes, for a while we ran two spaces, but then it got to be just too much.
And now you're in Chelsea, I believe.
Yeah, we're in Chelsea. On 20th Street is our main space, and we have a second space on 24th Street between 10th and 11th Avenue.
And there you're showing contemporary art?
Primarily, yes. Years ago, many years ago, it's got to be 10 or 12 now, we did a show called Trilogy. It was Man Ray, Duchamp, and Picabia, but that was a little different for us. But yes, contemporary art.
Now, one thing that the school gives you that you cannot get in New York is the space, I suppose.
Yes. in this space, the flexibility for a lot of our artists who work on large scales.
And some of the shows you've had have been made with this space in mind, I think, too. Is that correct?
Yes. The first exhibition of Nick Cave that we had, it wasn't for this space. It was the work that we had that then went to New York for his exhibition. But often it's really hard. A lot of Nick's work is installation-oriented, and it's difficult to place works and collections. The shows in New York go by so fast. It's usually 5 weekends. And so having this space to be able to photograph the work, to be able to bring people, museums came to preview. So it gave a whole kind of length to the exhibition. The following summer, I put together the show of El Anatsui, The Five Decades, which was such a rewarding project for me and so interesting to see, you know, the evolution of his work and how things come back and repeat.
And you've represented him in New York.
Yes, I do.
It was, of course, a wonderful show.
Thank you. I was so proud of it, and it ended up going on to a museum in Australia, Carriage Works, where it got a lot of attention. It was his first exhibition on that continent, so that was really something.
And the shows are here for how long?
Well, now we're on a schedule where we're doing 2 shows per year, so basically probably 5 months per show.
And you're open all year long?
Yes, we're open on Saturdays from 11 to 5, except for Christmas or New Year's, if it happens to fall on a Saturday. We're going to be opening with our new exhibition on June 25th. Everybody is welcome.
What is the new exhibition?
Well, I don't have a title yet, but it's an exhibition that's going to include all kinds of things. We're going to have these incredible, in the main space, these castles. They're copies of the slave castles in Ghana. However, they're also coffins. They're made by Pajo, the famous coffin maker. Claude, my partner in the gallery, Claude Simard, who passed away, unfortunately, about 3 years ago, had commissioned Pajo to do these amazing castles. So what are we going to do with these castles? Well, they're going to be part of a show, and there's going to be work like this. And that's Sebastian. He was a king of Portugal for a short time, although he was Spanish. And that's an early work. And all kinds of things. I can elaborate more later, but contemporary work that's made, like recent, up, and then very historic things that will juxtapose.
And right now you have a group show.
Yes, up on the second floor, we have an exhibition called Home Room.
And on the first floor, the photographer,
Andres Serrano.
With a lot of the notorious work.
Yes.
And also some portraits. I didn't really realize that he did those.
Yeah, well, I was so fortunate. I mean, again, this space allows me to do things like this because I've known Andres for a while, and it all of a sudden became an idea, and it was so wonderful to bring it to fruition because here we have 3 decades of his work. I was very fortunate. I contacted collectors who owned his work and begged them to loan it, and we got a lot of the like early important pieces. And yes, he's done a lot of series that people aren't as aware of. Very strong. And which series were you thinking of? The Americans? Yeah, where he went across, like, trying to figure out what it meant to be American. You have the whole cross-section of every kind of person. He did that right after 9/11.
And have you represented him for a long time?
No, I actually have not. And this is just the beginning of a relationship. And in fact, in September in New York, we're going to show his torture series, the recent work that we have here in the main space, which becomes more and more relevant every day.
They really are scary, too.
Yeah, they are. So it was really exciting to be able to put up this exhibition. So I hope people come see it. It's up for a few more months.
Now, you seem to draw an audience from a pretty wide area.
Yeah, we were really surprised how that has continued to happen, and pleased. Because when we first thought of doing this, working and having a gallery at the school and doing Nick Cave's show, we never considered that we would be open quite as much as we are, you know, all year round. And so I think it was the people wanting to come that made us realize, oh my God, there's people that will come. I mean, even on last Saturday, we had over 70 people. I know that's not a lot, but it's the middle of the winter on a cold, cold day. So I thought, that's pretty good.
Now, going back to the Nick Cave show, those wonderful big figures, those were something that he had already done, or were they specific to this space?
Those, many of which he had done, but they were for our exhibition that we were having in New York that fall. So they were done, but everything was hijacked here and installed and photographed and kind of previewed.
I thought they could be footmen for a very fancy banquet.
I loved how he installed that. I gave him carte blanche, and he really was the one who did that installation.
Now, who does all that beading?
He works with assistants and different people that help him.
But in his own studio?
Yeah. He has a whole group of people who work very diligently.
It looks like it would take an army.
Yes. Well, they're very focused, and it's quite amazing.
He's a Chicago artist?
Yeah. Well, he was born in Missouri, but has been living in Chicago for quite a while, and is based there now.
And you've represented him in New York?
Yes, for quite a while, probably at least a decade now.
Now, as far as the Tal Anatsui?
Yes, that was 5 decades. So that was really, I had the idea, two of his traveling shows that had been put together that were traveling to museums were over, and I was holding all this work for him, and I started getting this idea, this could be something really nice at the school. And so little by little, we started putting it together, and it was really quite extraordinary. You know, he worked in photography, he worked in ceramic and wood, and then the work that he's known for.
Do those sort of compact down?
When he sends them to us, they're amazingly economical in terms of, yes, he folds them really carefully, and, you know, often it's this small box. And a few times I've been surprised when the show arrives and the crate is really small, and I think, uh-oh, something got lost. But once we unfold them, we don't tend to fold them back again. We're concerned of the metal fatigue. And so we have them on big rolls or very folded very gently into crates.
And some of them 25 or 30 square feet, I
think. Probably at least, if not bigger.
And he's gotten, I think, enough recognition even to have been on the cover of Time magazine at this point.
Yes, he's really almost like a rock star when he goes out with us. People want his autograph and stuff.
Now, you have plenty of room here for storage as well.
Correct. And that was a lot of the impetus behind doing this, was for storage.
And you keep a staff here as well as the city.
Yes.
And one of the things I saw on the way up here was, up to this room, that is, the material you're putting together to send to a museum show.
Yes, it's going to the Tang Museum up at Skidmore College. It's, again, a whole mix of things. It's inspired by Claude Simard, my late partner in the gallery, who was a ravenous collector. I mean, both of us came to the gallery business because I think deep down we were collectors. And so that was something that we always enjoyed. Of course, at the beginning, when we were struggling and didn't have any money, you know, maybe we could buy one thing and pay it off. And little by little, Claude became insatiable. And he was, even though he was buying stuff every day for the gallery. And so Ian Berry, the curator of the Tang, knew him very well and has been really diligent going through the collection, selecting things. And so it's going to be, I believe, really a very strong exhibition. It opens in April.
So how did you come to this area?
I grew up in Williamstown, Massachusetts, actually. And all of a sudden, after not wanting to ever leave New York on the weekends, I suddenly wanted to be outside again and in green and in nature. And so originally we were looking for a place up around Williamstown. My folks were still living there, and realized after the third weekend it was just too far. And so we decided to, you know, think about coming a little, you know, closer to the city. And I have friends from college who live nearby, and I always loved it around here, the Chatham area.
And if I'm not mistaken, you ride horses.
Correct. So that was also why I wanted to come back. I stopped for quite a while, 19 years, and missed it a lot.
And you're back in the saddle
again. Back in the saddle, just came from riding. But you know, one thing, if you can edit this in somewhere, I wanted to mention that Nick Cave has this huge installation up at Mass MoCA right now. Mass MoCA in their main gallery in the big, big space, Nick Cave has a solo show. It's an immersive installation, and it's up through September. It's a must-see. I was just there on Saturday. Bill T. Jones performed and did a dance that was choreographed as a response to Nick's installation. So the dance was done within the space, and it was remarkable.
Talk about this exhibition, Homeroom.
Well, I'm afraid now I'm going to miss some of the artists, but Homeroom, which, you know, we all take it for granted as Americans, that, like, what Homeroom is. But I realized after I had titled the show Homeroom and just, like, assumed that that was a worldwide expression, I found out that non-Americans didn't have that same thing. One of my clients, who happens to be Turkish, said to me, "By the way, Jack, what is homeroom?" And I'm like, "What? What do you mean?" Because I thought it was this kind of shared consciousness. And so all of a sudden, the whole definition changed. But it's a group exhibition that includes sculpture, painting, video. We're very pleased to present Laurie Simmons' video here. It's a very important seminal work that I can't remember the title of right now. But it's really masterfully done, and it's a large-scale projection. Michael Snow, another video artist, a senior video artist. Carlos Vega, with two large paintings that he spent years doing, portraits of families that he did from memory. We have Huma Baba, who's a Pakistani artist, and I've admired her work for quite a long time. I don't represent her, but she comes here courtesy of Salon 94 Gallery in New York. Enrique Martinez Celaya, who was born in Cuba and lives in Los Angeles now, is in one room, one of the classrooms with paintings and sculpture. He'll be exhibiting next month in New York with us with new works. Becky Suss as well. She's a new artist with us. She's from Philadelphia, and she's a painter. And we have three of the works here that will be in her upcoming show in April in New York. So a little preview.
Now, how do you find these artists from these far-flung places?
Searching, looking. I mean, although also people bring me things, Ella Natsui, although I knew the work, that was an introduction by Okwien Wazor, the great Nigerian curator. And, you know, he was close with Elle, and he really believed that Elle should be in my gallery. And so he came and he put us together. But often it's kind of a searching, looking, like always being open to something new, but always be open to something, even if you think it's like not at all interesting. It could be after you think about it for a little while.
And you have a sort of stable of artists at this point.
Yes, I do. I'm very fortunate with the artists that I work with.
How did you become a gallerist? What was your background? Did you have an academic background in art history, something like this?
Not enough. I sure would have liked to. And I grew up loving art. My parents always took me to museums, and I grew up in Williamstown. And in fact, I used to love going to the Clark and all of that as a kid, and I was very much exposed. And it's not really something that you can go out and learn. It's kind of from within. But I think that the part that always informed me, and Claude as well, was as collectors. And because if I walk into a studio and I want to own everything in the room, I'm pretty confident that it's, you know, something I should take in the gallery.
How did you and Claude become partners?
We met in Provincetown, Massachusetts, the summer of 1984. Claude was a very good artist, and I had gone up to Provincetown to open a gallery for some friends of mine who had an empty building, didn't know what else to do with it. And I met Claude, and he was the first exhibition. It was very successful, and one thing led to another.
And you went to Washington.
Went to Washington, of all places. But I had gone to school there, and I was afraid to jump into the New York art scene, just like green and virginal.
But a few months gave you the confidence, obviously.
A few months made us realize we had to be in New York if we wanted to be contenders. We could be fine as a little peripheral gallery. And sometimes, you know, it's easier because you can take all, if you play your cards right, you could take the successful stuff from New York and Europe, and you go to art fairs, and you don't have to deal with the public on a daily basis. But we didn't want that. We wanted to be, like, represent artists and be in an international art world. And we just felt we couldn't do that from D.C.,
Has the atmosphere changed in New York for artists?
Well, it's so expensive. That's what's really hard for artists, is space is so expensive. But I'm working with the new young artist, Nina Shamel Abney, and her studio's out in New Jersey. Brooklyn isn't that cheap anymore. And so it's, you know, it's really hard for artists in terms of space and having their own time to work, having that luxury of the free time.
Even Hudson has become kind of an alternative for Brooklyn.
Yeah, it really has. And that's nice. I think the train makes it, you know, possible, although it's so expensive.
You have lectures as well, or talks, or...
Yes,
appearances.
Yes, we've done a few lectures, and David Smith has done concerts here. He does, I think, two a year right now, and they're really on a high, high level, really world class. Do you know David?
I interviewed David last month.
Okay, so you know David and his people.
He was very excited about the particularly the music he was doing this time and how it would... resonate.
It was inspiring. And yeah, I'm so proud to do things like that. We've had a few book signings and a few meetings here and there for people who needed a space to congregate, but we don't encourage that. And we had a wedding, one of my artists, Hank Willis Thomas, and Rujeko were married here. And that was very exciting this fall.
So it's become part of the Kinderhook community.
Yeah, it really has. We've been very embraced by the community. They've been terrific.
So now we are joined by Carlos Vega, an artist and partner at the school.
My pleasure to be here with you.
How long have you been involved?
We've been involved since 2013, when it was, well, long before because at the beginning we were just looking for a place where to play around with the collection, because we are in this enterprise out of a real love for objects and believing that objects are vessels for meaning. And at the beginning we were just looking for an empty box that will not burn. So we were looking for something made out of brick. And then in 2013, Jack got a vision of seeing the building for sale. Quite fast, we got a team of architects, engineers, and everything. Although at the beginning, we thought that we were living a nightmare. Everything took shape quite fast. And since then, it really has become a beautiful playground. It really is. Because this is where we see our hobby, our passion in life to be free range. Here we don't have the limitations of New York where things have to pay for itself and there is a lot of people that depends on the prosperity of the gallery. Here is almost like a laboratory of what is possible with a large scale. Jack has been associated with artists, with some of them for almost 30 years. And this gives us the opportunity of playing the Wizard of Oz, where you can put together a vision of artists' work including time on it. So you can see their evolution over decades. Something that at the gallery, because of space limitation, is impossible. Here, with this expansive space, you can see the interest of artists throughout their lifetime. And I think for anybody who is a real art lover, that's what you really want to see, is how these persons have kept a focus on his or her interest throughout a lifetime. I think it's a life dream for many people. Normally, you need the institution to be able to achieve that, but in this case, we changed the terms. Here, you can see an artist's career on a private space.
Now, in doing the space, some of the rooms were sort of left raw also. How did you make that decision?
Well, it was mostly out of experimentation. At a certain point, we ran out of steam and out of time, really. That was the original energy. We had no time left. Immediately the friends and the public responded so beautifully to that sense of the before and after, that for us we have become blind to it, because that was the canvas that we were working on. But by contrasting with the finished room, it became this kind of, some people say it was almost like a German or a European feeling to the building, where you could see the raw space and the finished space.
Well, the fact that the finished space is so perfectly finished kind of makes the primitive all the more beautiful.
Thank you. For me also, the beauty about the primitive space is that you can see the evolution of the place through. If you adjust your eyes, you can see how in the 60s the ceiling was dropped, the clock was moved, the windows were blocked on the top. So it's almost like an X-ray of the, or like a time machine. You can see how the building went through the evolution of a century. That's the life of the building.
How old is the building, actually?
It was built in 1929 and then finished in 31. And one of our claims to fame is that it was inaugurated by FDR just before he became president.
Is that right?
Yes.
And at the time, it was a very proud building. It was the best architectural techniques of the time, the poured concretes, the cinder blocks, no asbestos, thank God.
But it's like a Federal Revival style done in a very kind of palladial style of the building and just built like buildings aren't put together today.
And when Jack mentioned the Federal Revival, that was not just by chance. At that time, they were thinking that they were building the workers of the future. So they were giving them that the dignity of the building was very important, not just because of the historical corniness. It was to build also the character of the students. They were entering into palaces or temples. This was really the vision, to create the best money could buy at a time where education was a real catapult for society, for a better future.
But then they forgot.
They forgot.
Only because when we came, the rooms were like lowered down to... That top window wasn't there. So rooms were really a weird scale in order to like save heat. But ugly drop ceilings you probably remember from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, those basically had almost no R value of what we have today. So it was just like an ugly thing.
So it wasn't just a matter of walking in. I mean, there was major work on all fronts when you took the building.
Yes, but we were what we call pleasantly naive because we never realized that the way these buildings were built were it's like a conductor of heat out. And so a lot of places that let these buildings go, they did it because, you know, it was just so impractical to redo everything. And we didn't really realize that at the time, at the beginning, but... Luckily, that's good, because we're here today.
I suppose you have to maintain a certain temperature and so on for the
yes,
the benefit of the art.
Well, after we realized that we had bitten off so much, we ended up doing a whole geothermal thing here. So that's really actually, I love the system. We feel so good that we're not burning oil, and it's an amazing thing.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah, it's all upfront cost.
And how did you say you found the architect?
We have a connection with Granada in Spain. Antonio was a local hero, a very well-respected architect, who was an innovator, not just by aesthetics, but also the way he thought about architecture, how he embraced limitations as a way of coming to a great solution. So Antonio was also, by chance, our next door neighbor in Spain. And over a period of 3 or 4 years, we worked with him with several projects in Manhattan. When the gallery was looking for a new location, Antonio did 2 or 3 beautiful projects for that they never took place. But over those 3 years, we came to love his mind and his problem-solving attitude. And when the building was purchased, we offered to him, and Antonio chewed on the concept for maybe 3 weeks, 3 months, and at the end I say, Antonio, you have to give us a solution. What are you going to do? And Antonio whisper me the solution, and I told Jack, and Jack cried out loud that he was crazy, he fucking crazy, how he will do it. Anyway, the idea was to excavate. And
we talked about that.
And really, that was the most genius idea. And he saved tons of money because he didn't interfere with the foundation of the building. And he created extra footage for perimeter galleries and a wonderful center space. But it was just the most ingenious idea to go down. And the beauty about the school really is that the whole community have a little bit of their heart is in the building. So every time we open our doors, people come with a sense of ownership. And that's, it's been beautiful for us. Because, you know, it makes the giving more it's more satisfactory to give when people already feel that it's there for them to take. So I love that connection of the town.
Yeah, the town really loved this building and they always kept it up. I mean, it's the largest building in the town, so but they were always very proud of it. So
and they still are.
Still are.
Whoever worked on this building avoided the whole recession, the whole depression of the 20s and 30s. So the people who work here, they were happy workers. I
29,
think 1930, 31, they were the toughest years of the recession.
But also, in case you went to school here, because it was also not only the high school, but then it became the whole school, and then it became the elementary school. We're doing an oral history on the school with students from Skidmore. Rachel Fainter, who is one of the managers here, is organizing that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was the first movement from Arthur Foote's Suite for String Orchestra. Now here's Camille Saint-Saëns, La Nuit.